Today we jolt you out of your midwinter blues with some titles all about the good life, from working out to simply hanging out. A shot in the arm, this week on The Stack. Hello and welcome to The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. It's the cruelest time of year, the nights long, the willpower to maintain New Year's resolutions in short supply, if not already exhausted. For the sake of moral support, this week we're speaking to three people who make magazines that make you feel good. Women's Health has had a bumper year, bucking market trends to grow consistently, both in terms of print circulation and brand expansion. It's profited from having a steady hand on the tiller in the form of Claire Sanderson, who joins me now. Claire, welcome to The Stack. Thank you very much for coming to see us. It's great to have you with us. And we have, well, several editions of Women's Health as well before us. A beautiful magazine and a pretty beautiful year, all things being equal, that you've enjoyed in the big chair there. How would you sum it up? It's the journalist's lot to come up with sound bites, but how's it been treating you?
It's exceeded all my expectations. My job is that I'm not just in charge of the magazine, I'm across the whole brand. So events, brand extensions, product licensing. But it's the magazine is the bread and butter of the brand, the mothership of the brand. And Women's Health is just doing so well. It's about to post, I believe, an 11th consecutive growth in ABCs. That is unheard of in the UK at the moment. You know, we won the PPA Award Magazine of the Year for 2 years consecutively. No magazine has ever done that. And the beauty of Women's Health, and what I'm particularly proud of, is that we are growing organically. So we don't cut price. You know, we haven't slashed down to a pound. We don't cover mount, so there's no free lipsticks. And all power to the magazines that are doing that, but it's quite an expensive way to get circulation, whereas we haven't had to do that to grow our circulation. That said, in 2018, we are introducing PT Plus supplements. Men's Health do them at the moment. They do six a year. And they're small supplements that are put in a bag, and they are sort of mini workout guides or a guide to macros. So in May, you will see Women's Health first PT Plus supplement, and we're going to do three a year. So we are sort of getting into the cover mountain business, but we're not doing it to such an extent that some of the mags do it every month and giving away quite expensive, you know, nail varnishes and lipsticks, which are the cost base for that to the publishing house is quite high.
Well, exactly. And they're sort of value adds rather than, yeah, as you say, expensive additions on a month by month basis. How much of that comes down to having a clear vision of sort of purpose and where you fit in? Because we're going to have some broader conversation about, you know, is Women's Health a health title? Is it a fitness title? Is it a well-being title? Does it matter whether we attempt to pigeonhole it or otherwise? What's the sort of editorial approach that presumably you have to ensure you keep a tight rein on with your team? And do you spend much or any time thinking about those kinds of questions? Or is it more about what sings on the page, what's relevant to the reader?
Well, we're very much a wellness title, although when we go to market, we say we're a lifestyle title, because we are, because we have a very holistic approach to wellness. So there's everything in there, from fitness, nutrition, athleisure, which is the industry way of saying fashion, sports kit. But we are wellness overall. So, and the reason why we're doing so well is that wellness amongst women is on a trajectory that no one could have anticipated. When I joined Women's Health, I'd just been on maternity leave with my second daughter. So I was in this little bubble with a little baby in Winchester, where I live, completely oblivious to what was happening in London. And when I came back after a year off, it was unrecognisable, the wellness landscape. You know, women and men are paying £25 to go to a gym class and spending more on the kit that they wear to the gym than they would for a frock to go to a wedding, and not thinking twice about it, spending £100 on a pair of leggings that make you feel amazing and suck you all in, which is very important when you're a woman. You know, it's very acceptable. And I think Women's Health was very lucky to be at the forefront of that and before it exploded. So I would say we're maybe not responsible, but we certainly, we were there driving it, you know, in the sort of background. And we were just very fortunate that our subject matter is so relevant to British women globally, in fact, because we're a huge international brand. We're in 42 countries. We have 32 editions. But Women's Health UK is doing particularly well. We are growing, which is unusual, even amongst Women's Health globally.
Now, tell me a bit more about some of these other
facets, and you've alluded to them already, and actually you mentioned people spending £25 to go to a gym session, this sort of thing. And that's obviously something that's of increasing importance, I guess, to women's health. How savvy a broader sort of business operator do you need to be to do what you do? And we've talked often on this programme before about how to manage what digital content you do and what are the other plays, what are the value adds. You know, we do events here at Monocle, and now events are something that are a really important part of the women's health sort of armory as well. How do you balance up the sort of, as you said, the fundamentals, which is the printed offering, with these other things, which are very important in their own way, aren't they?
Oh, they're hugely important. And if we're going to grow as a brand, we have to expand our brand extensions to survive. You know, we are growing in circulation, but I'm not arrogant enough to say that that will continue for years and years. So I'm very much across everything, and events are a big, big focus for us. We were half owned by a company called Rodale, and then Hearst bought us recently all out. And I've noticed a significant gear change even in the last 6 weeks of the focus that's been put on us by Hearst, because suddenly we have the power of Hearst, but the full power of Hearst behind us. So the full commercial team, Hearst Live, which are our events team, and everyone wants a slice of women's health because we have a highly engaged audience. So my job now is spreading myself quite thinly, and I'm learning every day. You know, you fake it till you make it a lot of time, don't you? And you just have to trust your gut instinct and know your audience. And I think I do know my audience because I am the audience. Maybe I'm a little bit older than our core audience now because I'm 40 in 2 months, which is nothing to celebrate. Yeah.
Virtually exactly the same position. So, yeah.
But I love health and fitness. I'm, you know, very much, even though I am a mum, I'm not defined by being a mum, which is what the Women's Health Reader is. So I think if you know your audience and I know what a Women's Health Reader wants, then I can use that gut instinct across all aspects of the brand.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting, you talked about the idea of a well-being title. We've been on a couple of different sort of adventures around the world of publishing on our programme this week. And I'd be intrigued to hear a couple of your insights on some of the journeys we've been on this week for the programme. One such is in New Zealand. International award-winning photographer Craig Leavers seems to be living the surfer's dream. His house overlooks one of New Zealand's best surf beaches. He edited New Zealand Surfing magazine for 8 years and has ridden the waves with the best Kiwis in the business for practically his whole life. Sounds idyllic, but as Craig explained to our contributor Claire Urban, shooting surfers isn't always a barrel of laughs. Craig and Claire recently spent a journey back from Auckland Airport dissecting the surf mag industry.
I grew up, like most New Zealand surfers, completely and utterly consuming magazines. I mean, we grew up in a culture of, you know, surf mags being everywhere, international surf mags coming into New Zealand. Probably the biggest ones were American Surfer and, without a doubt, Trax from Australia. And here in New Zealand, there's like a really rich history of producing surf print. So I grew up reading New Zealand Surfing magazine and Freebird magazine and that. And then when I was 23, I got offered, I was already shooting photos, and I got offered the opportunity to interview for the surf mag, and yeah, took it and ended up getting a job at New Zealand Surfing magazine.
Can you remember what it was when you were younger that you absolutely loved about surf magazines?
With Trax magazine, it was the cheekiness of it and the irrelevance of it. Like, they didn't take themselves too seriously, and I think that's something that's at surfing at its best, is when surfers don't take themselves too seriously. And at the end of the day, surfing is about having fun. And then there's the visual side of it, where, especially in print, surfing lends itself super well to print because it is such a visually pleasing activity. And as a young surfer, you're sort of consuming all this. You know, you're looking at body positioning and stuff like that, and you're sort of learning, even through stills, how guys are doing manoeuvres, and you just want to know about everything, you know. So, and at its best, that's what surf print used to do.
Do you think that surf print is still doing that?
It is, but it's totally having now to compete with online content and online video content. A lot of the surf mags are trying to run to the old formulas, and those old formulas just don't work anymore because there's other media in place.
So can you tell us about how the industry is in New Zealand at the moment? Are there many magazines out there? Are any of them independent?
There's two mainstream surf mags available in New Zealand at the moment. New Zealand produced magazines. One is my old title, which is New Zealand Surfing Magazine, and it's produced by a small publishing house based out of the Hibiscus Coast, but their editor lives in Gisborne. And then the other one, which is sort of a relatively new one on the scene, is called Damaged Goods Magazine, and it's done by two guys, Skip James and Jerry Orbiton, and it's done out of Mount Maunganui. I think Damaged Goods is doing a better job of moving with the times. Unfortunately, New Zealand Surfing Magazine is still trying to work to the formula that worked in the 80s and 90s. In my opinion, you may need to get with the times, basically.
So what do you think that would involve?
I think you have to acknowledge that the internet is there, and so what you've got to do as a magazine is produce stuff that's not instantaneous, better research stories. So, you know, magazines have to move, arguably, into a thing of just a well-researched story that's well-written. And you certainly don't get that online at the moment. A lot of stuff online is advertorial and it's high visual impact, which is unreal. Like, I mean, there's nothing wrong with high visual impact. We all love it. But there's room for other stuff as well.
Can you think of other magazines that you think are really nailing it? Like how you would want to see a surf magazine nail it?
There are surf mags that are nailing it. I think the ones that are appealing to a slightly older demographic are doing a really good job. And that's things like Surfers Journal, which is based out of California. And in Australia, there's White Horses. And Surfing World, which has been going for decades. And they've reinvented themselves multiple times. And I think they're all doing quite a good job of it.
Obviously, photography is a huge part of surf magazines. And you're a photographer.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that and how much fun it must be to be taking photos of surfing?
It actually fucking sucks because you're not surfing. To be honest, like, if you're taking photos, you're not surfing yourself, and surfing is an incredibly selfish pastime. Surfers want to go surfing, and I'm a surfer first, and if it's pumping, I want to go surfing. But being a surf photographer is really good. You get excited about, you know, capturing that moment. You kind of sort of share that moment with that surfer when they do something really good. My specialty is I swim out and shoot with a water housing. You're in the water and you're sort of getting, you know, you're immersed in the waves, and there's a lot of adrenaline going on because you can get really fucked up. So that's fun, you know, like it's fun to be sort of testing your own boundaries and getting smashed, and it's good fun.
So Claire, that was, amongst other things, surf photographer Craig Leavis talking to our contributor Claire Urban about New Zealand Surfing Magazine and tracking surfing down under in print. And one of the things that's interesting there, and I wonder if this speaks to some of the challenges you face on women's health, is this idea of being authoritative about something that people take really seriously, but without being po-faced and without losing the fun, which is also supposed to be at the heart of it. And I guess if people talk about healthy living, working out, diets, you talked about the kit that people have earlier, and some people can be, to my mind, almost too serious about the kit and less about what they're doing. Is that important to retain a sense of fun? And how do you ensure that you are delivering a fun message as well as something that's constructive and maybe a bit challenging? The right kind of challenging, I suppose.
It's the tone of our copy, and I pride myself on the tone of our copy. And even things like captions on pictures, our subs are brilliant at coming up with funny captions. So even though our content is serious in the sense that it's telling people what to eat and what to do with their bodies, so everything's science-backed, we have to deliver that in a fun, irreverent way. And I think we manage that in women's health. We manage it with our colour palette as well. It's all very bright and engaging and very appealing to a female audience. But it's the tone of the copy. The tone of the copy is written in such a way that you could be speaking to your friend down the pub about it, or at a class drinking a protein shake afterwards. It's not preachy. It's a beautiful magazine. It's a very aspirational magazine. But what another thing that that guy just said was people read surf prints because they want to be part of that community almost. You know, they want to feel like they're part of that surf community. And I think that's what Women's Health is. It's people who want to be part of a well-being community. I think it's very all-embracing at doing that.
And I just wonder, in terms of how you go about sort of maintaining that tone, is that about thinking of a hypothetical reader? Because you mentioned, you know, the demographic sweep is fairly focused, and obviously you'll have your, you know, marketing departments will be very specific about the kinds of things, but it's quite broad. But do you try and almost, I don't know, develop like the personification, like an individual almost? What's the way to communicate best with them?
You've hit the nail on the head in that it is actually very broad for us, which is one of the reasons why we're growing, because wellness is non-age specific. So whereas magazines like Cosmo are very much targeted at women in their late teens, early 20s, and, you know, wellness for women now goes from 18 to 55. And we don't record readers younger than 18, but I know we have them because I've got nieces who read it and she's 16. And then also, you know, women who are 45, 50 these days look amazing and blah, blah, blah. So we have to appeal to all those. So, but what our readers are is, you know, intelligent, high earning, professional women. So as long as, you know, in my mind, I think also the key reader is probably about 30. You know, she works full time. She's educated. She's university educated. She's got twice the national average disposable income. So it's speaking to that woman in a fun, non-condescending way.
And what about rivals on the newsstand? Because we wrestle with this at Monocle. Do you look at women's health and how it sits in that health and wellness and fitness landscape? Do you look at it against all, I don't know, lifestyle titles, as unhelpful as that may be? Or is it important to look at it just on the newsstand, full stop, and consider that it's part of that whole ecosystem, if you like?
Yeah, I would think the latter. I would say we don't have a competitor. And the reason for that is we sell, I think, it's between 75 and 80% of the wellness market in publishing. So of all the women's fitness titles out there, the other five or six only take up 20% of the market. We sell 80%. So we don't have a competitor in that market. But likewise, we don't really have a competitor in the women's lifestyle market or luxury market because, you know, Cosmo is very different, Elle is very different, Harper's is very different, Marie Claire, they're all there's more similarities between those than us with them. Also, research has shown us that we have the highest percentage of soulless readership. So more women only read Women's Health and don't buy anything else because we are so different to the offerings. So it's, you know, when I go, sometimes I see us on the newsstand next to Weight Watchers magazine. That makes me cross because I don't think, and it's potluck where you find it on the new, which it really makes me cross. And I know that it's something our company battles with every day because some places feel that we belong alongside those sort of wellness titles. And then other places put us in with the women's luxury market. And I would suggest that's where we sit more, because if you're going to buy us and something else, I would think people are buying us and Elle or us and Cosmo.
What are the limits? We're going to hear another little package that we've got in a minute about a magazine which is focused really on, I guess, happiness, I think, is their brief. How much does the kind of psychology of well-being get into play here? Because obviously that's part of an overall picture of wellness. Is it harder to do well in a magazine? Or do you think it's again, if you have a great writer, they can tell a great story and they can get inside people's heads as easily?
Yeah, we've got a strong mind section, which is very much focused on mental well-being, because we did research last year, last summer, and the primary pillar that people read us for is nutrition. Second is mental well-being. Third is fitness, which surprised me. So we have a big focus to holistic wellness, and a huge part of that is mental well-being. So sleep. Even we have a feature coming up in April about psychobiotics, about how your gut health affects your mental health. So,
well, let's hear a bit from this next piece. This is from Spanish title Perdiz, which is a magazine about people and things that make them happy. We mentioned its launch 4 years ago. They're now on issue 9, with subjects ranging from a computer programmer turned professional corpse to an international hedge maze designer. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco recently spoke to Perdiz's editor, Marta Puigmesa.
Marta, it's a pleasure to have you on the stack again. I believe you were here 4 years ago when you launched the magazine. And tell us, for those that, you know, that don't know much about Perdiz magazine, it's a magazine about happiness. It's people like to say that people are interested only in negative things or tragedies, but clearly that's not the case, right?
We like to say that it's a magazine about things that make people happy, because we don't specifically talk about happiness, but about examples of people that are happy and satisfied with their lives. We don't tell people what they should do in order to be happy, or even suggest that they should do anything. We simply show what makes others happy. And you can imagine how diverse that is. And that's what we want to, the message we want to give, the diversity of things that people do in order to give meaning to their life.
Well, precisely. And I have your latest issue here, issue 9. And there's a lovely story actually from England about a man who loved puzzles and how he creates, you know, those fascinating mazes around the world. I mean, he clearly has a fantastic job. I would say I want that job as well.
He's one of the most famous maze designers. And yeah, he's from England. And yeah, when we knew about him, we were completely amazed. And we said, we have to go there. And yeah.
And I would like to ask you, of course, you were on the stack on the beginning of the magazine, so it's been 4 years. So clearly, you know, it's a fantastic brand, doing very well. In terms of the business model of Perdiz, how was it for you in those 4 years? How did you manage, you know, to sustain, you know, such a lovely publication? Is it through subscription, newsstands? We're always very curious about those details.
So Perdiz, it generates money through sales and advertising, and we have also a subscription service. So for us, for Querida, which is the design studio, and also for me, it's more like, you know, our window display. So we do it for fun, and also it's, you know, it's like our spoiled baby, the place where we make, you know, our dreams true.
If I may ask, here on the stack, we usually have quite a few magazines, especially independent publications from Spain. Do you think it's becoming, or it is, a great market for this kind of publication?
What I know is that, you know, at the beginning when this first came out, there weren't a lot of print independent magazines here in Spain, but now there are quite a lot. Some people have asked me sometimes that, is it because of the crisis? Like, you know, that people didn't have jobs and then just, you know, had to create their own dream job because they didn't have another option. It's probably that it has something to do with that, you know, when there is a crisis, people have to use their creativity and apply it in their own ways. But I'm not sure. I mean, I didn't do it because of that reason.
I love your open letter on this latest issue as well, because, you know, you say this little things that bring so much joy. Like, and you give an example, having the biggest slice for pizza. I think that's a fantastic example, I have to say. Which other magazines actually make you happy, Marta, when you're reading in your house? Could be like a magazine or a newspaper. Are there any other publications that you enjoy?
I like to go to bookshops and browse all the magazines available there. I love classics like Colors or Adbusters. Well, Colors doesn't exist anymore in print, but our Adbusters. Also, there's a magazine called Pie Paper that I used to like a lot. It's not they're not doing it anymore. I think they have everything on the website now, but they don't do it anymore. And it was a theme specific, like, so every issue was a specific topic. Okay. And it was a little magazine. It was very special. I love it.
Marta Puigmasa there. An interesting stuff. And I think it's that idea of the holistic approach, Claire, is very important. And you mentioned, obviously, women's health being in the vanguard. When things are going well, as you mentioned, you've got a loyal following, there's brilliant sort of brand value ads and events that you can do. Is it easier, and again, this idea of pressure from without, not to sort of push too far? I mean, is it all about expansion? Do you feel you've got some slack to just kind of consolidate and make sure you can keep doing the stuff really well that you've been doing really well in the first 12 months? Is the sort of pace of the demands, whether that's on your time or on what you need to achieve, is it sort of manageable?
Well, I don't have work-life balance, but because I'm the brand ambassador, the brand custodian, they call me. So I do a lot of public speaking. I'm out there representing the brand. But I do feel that we need to strike while the iron's hot. And I think now is the time to amplify women's health. As I said, when we were half owned by Rodale, I don't feel we were amplified as much as we could have been. And I think wellness is on such an explosion, showing no sign of slowing down. I think we need to strike. The appetite is there for women's health. We are such a loved, trusted brand. And everyone wants to come to our events. Our events sell out, our products sell out, you know. So whereas you see with men's health, they do a lot of food products, you know, the sausages and the beef jerky and stuff. You'll see more of that stuff coming out with women's health this year. And I think there's an appetite for it. People trust us. And I think the possibilities are endless. I'm not saying we're doing this, but there's nothing to say we can't do protein powders, do our own athleisure wear. You know, there's so many things that we could do that I know there's an appetite for with our audience.
There's always an appetite for beef jerky, as I understand it. What about digital space? Because that's a conversation I always like to have, whether talking to a small indie startup or, you know, a big player from one of the big publishing houses. Is it a question of trying to frame or reframe the print content for digital? Is it always a completely different conversation? How divided is it? And it's interesting you keep coming back to things like events, which are traditional. They're about meeting people and about getting out there. And for me, they feel more like traditional media outreach than digital. But maybe that's just me. What's that digital? Is it a tricky balance? Do you enjoy that facet of it? How does it work?
The way digital and print, or digital and everything else, is run at Hearst is separate in the sense that we have a digital team who are under a different managing director, so they have their own targets to hit. And although I work closely with the digital editor on campaigns, and we do things like when we do a cover shoot, we'll send a videographer along who will do behind the scenes, so then that will be put up at our social channels to push people to buy the magazine, etc. But the actual content is not massively different, because it's all wellness, but digital is, there's a lot of listicles on there, you know, clicky headlines, etc. Whereas the magazine content, the print content, is probably a bit more considered and a bit more in depth and a bit more of a lean in experience, whereas digital you dip in and out of.
And it's very much there in the service of the print. That's still the mantra, I guess, through Hearst. I mean, that's what we understand, I suppose.
Well, the print is the mothership of a brand. And I think, you know, without print, the rest of it wouldn't be there. But I don't think the digital team would take lightly to be and say that they were there in service to print. Because they're doing amazingly well, our digital team. You know, they keep, every month they keep on having the best month ever. And their social reach is over a million, you know. So they're doing brilliantly at amplifying the brand and getting the name Women's Health out there, and that's what we need.
Indeed it is. Well, let's look very briefly sort of ahead into 2018. You've already sort of whetted our appetites with some broad brush things that could be happening. You can't give away any trade secrets or the inner workings of the sort of editorial little black book, but what are some of the things that your loyal readers can look forward to? Are there any particular stories which have been, I don't know, slow burns that are coming up or anything like that?
Well, sorry to hark back to events, but it's a big push for us this year. And I think you'll see more cross-brand events as well. It was announced this week that Hearst has bought BeFit, which is a huge fitness festival. And I think there'll be a lot of women's health involvement in that as well. But what you will see is just the brand name Women's Health in more places. So you're going to see it in your shops more in terms of products, not magazines. We're doing more bookazines, which are the sort of like hybrid magazine stroke books that we sell in WH Smith's for $9.99. So we're doing more of those. So I think what you'll see is women's health out there more.
I like it. We always like to end on a sort of upbeat and aspirational note. That was very optimistic. The force is with you. Claire, thank you very much for coming to see us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's it for this week's programme. Thanks to our producers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Rhys Sheridan, and our editors, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Comments or queries, as ever, are welcome. Get in touch with Fernando at fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next week. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.